Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about the state of intercollegiate sports. And it's certainly true that college administrators across the country will argue that it's a good thing for students to have the opportunity to participate in sports. And they'll further argue that, in fact, some of the things that they can learn on the field while they're playing sports can make a good complement to the kinds of things that they learn in the classroom. At the same time, we know that college athletics is a big business, and there are many high-profile programs, particularly those programs of basketball and football, that generate millions and millions of dollars in revenue. This morning, we'll try to talk a little bit about sports at colleges and universities, talking about some of the pressures facing both players and coaches, and look at some of the concerns that many people have that college athletes may indeed be exploited. And our guest for the show is someone who has been involved in college athletics at a number of levels. His name is Peter Roby, and he is the director of the Center for the Study of Sport in Society at Northeastern University, and that's in Boston, and has had that job since July of 2002. He does a lot of speaking and writing on the subject of college athletics. Before he took up the job at the center, he was the vice president of U.S. marketing at Reebok. Before that, he was a college basketball coach. He served 6 seasons as head basketball coach for Harvard University and 3 as Harvard's assistant basketball coach. Before that, he also worked as a coach at Stanford, at Dartmouth, and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And before that, he was a college player. He went to Dartmouth, and he was co-captain of the basketball team there, where he earned a bachelor's degree in government. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. But, of course, anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Roby, hello.
Hello, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Let me ask you a question to start. This is, I know, kind of a big question, but given that you were a college athlete some time back and were also involved in a coach, particularly if you look at your experience when you were playing basketball when you were at Dartmouth, mm-hmm. and make some comparison between what that experience was like and the experience of student athletes today, how do you think things have changed?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that question because, you know, I graduated from college in 1979, and I've used that day as a real seminal moment in college basketball popularity because that was the year of the Final Four between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, Indiana State versus Michigan State. And I think that kind of transcended college basketball with regard to its appeal and interest on the fans' part and television, and has really never looked back. So I think prior to it, it wasn't nearly the kind of business enterprise that it is today. It really wasn't seen necessarily as the huge entertainment value that it is today. And as a result of that, money has become so much more a part of the equation and is factored into decisions that people make with regard to recruiting, building facilities, building programs, hiring coaches, firing coaches, and some of the bad decisions that are made with regard to academic fraud and recruiting violations. So it's not only the beginnings of basketball with regard to the entertainment value, as I said, but also that was the year that ESPN came into existence, 1979, and we all know the kind of impact that that 24-hour sports network has had, and it's all kind of happened at the same time.
Yeah. Well, you know, it strikes me that we talk about college athletics as a monolithic kind of thing, when clearly it's not, and I think you really have to distinguish between programs where students get the opportunity to you know, who knows, play tennis, play golf, do gymnastics, softball, those things that, chances are not big revenue-producing programs.
Correct.
And then the big schools that are Division I schools where they have big basketball and football programs, the ones who make those programs that make lots and lots of money, and where there's a greater opportunity for students to at least consider the possibility of going from there to doing that for a living. So, you know, and that's not also not to say that there aren't not problems on all levels and
right.
different kinds of problems, but
right.
it seems to be that maybe too often what we do is we say, you know, what's wrong with college sports today, as
that's
if
true.
It was all one big thing, and it's really, you kind of got to take it apart.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement and a fair way of describing what's going on in college athletics. You certainly have what you consider a real hierarchy with regard to conferences and schools playing at a very high level in Division I and in football in Division I-A, where it's the biggest schools and programs in the country, like the University of Illinois and the schools in the Big Ten, the Pac-10, the SEC, the ACC, the Big East, and the Big 12, just to name some of the big BCS conferences. And then you have a certain fall off, if you will, in terms of the amount of money that people are willing to invest, the number of scholarships involved, the size of the stadiums, and the importance that people place on their football and basketball programs at middle level conferences, the Ivy League, the Patriot League, the Atlantic 10, and some of those others. It doesn't mean that they're not striving to have competitive athletics, but they certainly aren't investing and don't have nearly the same expectation in terms of revenue. And then you have all the different divisions within the NCAA. So Division I, which is mostly scholarship. Division II, which is scholarship, but different kinds of academic expectations and sizes of programs and number of sports sponsored. And then Division III, which is non-athletic scholarship, and in a lot of cases, much less aggressive in terms of recruiting.
Mm-hmm. College athletics seems to be in the news either when generally when there's bad news, it's going to be in the news. That is outside of the sports news. Mm-hmm. That'll be in the news if a school is charged with some sort of rule violation, or particularly if athletes are accused of behaving badly mm-hmm. off the field. And recently we've seen some stories like that of athletes who have been accused of crimes. There's also recently, for some reason, seems to be a lot of attention focused on the issue of hazing.
Right.
And we had a story like that here in our part of the country, and it happens other places as well.
Yeah.
But the one thing that seems to come up again and again is the issue, and it's, you know, the question is posed not just for athletes who are in big-time football and basketball players, but perhaps others, particularly when they're accused of behaving badly, and that is, have we somehow, as these kids grow up and have given paid a lot of attention to their athletic prowess, and maybe the reason that they're in college is that we've given them a scholarship because of their athletic ability. Have we raised a class of individuals who think that somehow they're above the law and that they are a privileged group and they can essentially do whatever they want and get away with it?
Well, I certainly think that there's a number of athletes today on college campuses that do have that attitude. But just as you suggested in the first piece that we discussed, that you can't paint everybody with the same brush, I think it's true with regard to athletics, because there's plenty of serious students who are there to get an education that also have some ability as an athlete that are pursuing their athletic dreams on the fields on numerous colleges and universities around the country that aren't getting in the news for all the bad reasons. They're actually doing positive things on their campuses in terms of engaging in community service and being in leadership positions and leading by example. So, but because of the attention that's paid to sport in our country and the importance placed on it in our culture, you are going to have those situations when they're negative that are going to make national news and they're going to be, in some ways, international stories. So we can't hide from it. We have to expect and accept it. And now the issue is, what are we going to do about it? And it's interesting, in your opening, you talked about how we college administrators have come to assume that the student athletes that participate in sports in their schools will benefit from all the things that happen on the field of play. And I've been one of several people that follow these kinds of things that suggest that that's not inherently so anymore. We just can't assume that there are valuable life lessons that people are going to pick up from their participation in sport unless the adults and those involved with the sports are overt and calculating about what it is that they're trying to teach young people from a social standpoint, from an educational standpoint, through their participation in sport. Because we're seeing enough examples of kids that are making really bad decisions, involved in really bad behavior, that are part of sports teams. So we can't just assume that all the value that we think is inherent in sport is going to get learned.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could talk about that a little bit more, because it certainly seems to me that whenever with college administrators, if you raise this question, why do we have sports at all?
Right.
And particularly, why do we have sports at the top level? Again, not to pick on these programs, but the big time football and basketball
right.
programs,
right.
They will make that argument. And it's the same argument they would make for giving students the opportunity to participate in any kind of sport at different sorts of levels. They say, well, we see that being able to play sports can fit in with the larger educational mission of the
right.
university. So they have this way of even rationalizing a Division I football program like we have and other Big Ten schools have, and saying, well, this is somehow a part of the educational mission and can be part of the student's educational experience. And while on one level you'd like to believe that that's right, mm-hmm. that could indeed be right, yeah, then you still have to ask some questions about, well, okay, does that really happen? So that gets to the very point that you just made.
Well, I think it's about perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think that's the issue. We're not suggesting, as you're saying, is that we're not suggesting that athletics in and of itself is bad. I think the issue is when you lose perspective on the role that it plays on that college campus, that's when you start to get the problems. You know, when you start the arms escalation where we have to build a bigger stadium than the folks that are competing against us in our conference, or we have to engage with the host programs on college campuses when recruits come on campus where there's girls that meet recruits and show them a good time because somebody else is doing it and we're afraid we're going to lose those recruits and as a result we won't get a BCS bid and down the road we go. So I do feel like athletics can, in fact, enhance the educational mission of the institution. It's just got to be done consistently and with the proper perspective. When we let the tail wag the dog is when we get in trouble.
Yeah. Well, there, though, some people, I think, might ask, they could see, again, the chance to play sports is a good thing, and somebody wanting to play tennis or golf or
right.
gymnastics or volleyball or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that when we get to the level of the way we play big-time football and basketball, really questioning the concept and of the student-athlete. And
right.
it's something like, you know, particularly if you talk to people in the NCAA, they almost insist on those two words going together, that you cannot have the one without the other, because they're trying to make this point that they're not simply athletes, they're also students. But
right.
you know, you have to wonder, at that level, do we have to ask the question, is to what extent does sports take up so much of their life and their energy
right.
that we have to question whether or not they're really students?
Right. And I think it's a valid point and one that has to continue to be asked in order to keep everybody honest and focused on what it is that they're supposed to be there to do. So I don't necessarily take offense when people ask that very question, because I think it puts the kind of pressure on everybody that's appropriate. And it makes us re-examine how we're going about identifying student-athletes and the role of the admissions office in the process of recruiting student-athletes and what kind of support systems are in place for student-athletes once they get on the campus. If we're going to ask them to invest that much time and energy in being competitive on the athletic fields, then we have to at least be able to provide them some sort of support so that they can, in fact, be as competitive on the field or be as competitive in the classroom as we want them to be on the field. And there are concerns that are legitimate that we're not being fair to the student-athletes, especially those that we're recruiting that come with less than stellar academic credentials, and then ask them to do all this work in addition to what they're supposed to do to study and have some sort of a social life to engage in all that's available on the college campus. So I do think and have continued to say that it's a matter of perspective. And if we could get some of the money involved in college athletics out of it, that we would end up having a system that we are more proud of and more comfortable with than maybe the system that we have today.
Yeah, just one further question, then I have a caller here. I promise I'll get to that person. Won't make them wait forever. It does indeed see the metaphor, the arms race metaphor. Some people might say that's a little bit over the top, but on the other hand, it does seem appropriate when colleges, when you start to talk with people, administrators about, well, could we have some kind of build down here? Is it actually possible to back off? And then they would probably say to you, you know, we're stuck because there is this belief that having a successful sports program for a big university can be an important marketing tool, and that somehow administrators think that alumni expect it and that it's something that attracts all kinds of students here, not just student athletes, and that one way or another, even though the money for the sports program stays in the sports program, they think that these things do indeed draw money to the university. And they would make this argument that says, you know, maybe we'd like to make some changes.
Right.
And we'd think that sport at whatever university we're talking about is overemphasized. But they might then say, but, you know, we can't. We can't back down from where we are. At least we can't, not unless we couldn't do it unless everybody did it.
Yeah, that's exactly what you hear, is that they don't want to do things unilaterally. They want to do it as a part of an overall commitment that the league that they participate in or the division that they participate in is willing to do. And I understand why they're doing that. They don't want to lose whatever competitive advantage they might have, or they don't want to be associated with losing programs, especially when they've tried to tout themselves as committed to excellence on all phases. So, you know, when Northwestern football, for example, was in that terrible losing streak, or Columbia University's football team was losing, you know, 40 games in a row, it's a real sense of embarrassment for everybody involved in the program. And I don't think anybody is suggesting that that's the level that people want to get to. We want those student athletes and everybody associated with the institution to feel a sense of pride about what's going on the field of play and being competitive. But being competitive and defining success can be a lot of different things. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to win a national championship every year. And I think that's part of what people have to do a better job of, is creating the perspective and defining success for themselves that doesn't necessarily have to be the way society or our competition wants to define it.
Our guest is Peter Robey. He is director of the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University in Boston. Has been there since July of 2002. He's also been a coach. He coached basketball at Harvard and has been a player. He played when he was at Dartmouth. He graduated there from there in 1979. He was co-captain of the basketball team. He got a bachelor's degree in government there from Dartmouth. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to bring in. Been patient with us, and we appreciate that. The caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I also think we need to consider how corrupting and contradictory big-time athletic programs can be to the academic mission of a university such as the University of Illinois. Here, our sports teams have a racist mascot by the name of Chief Illiniwek, which has recently been condemned as abusive and degrading by the NCAA. And they fought for 15 years to keep this thing. 2 years ago, the bigots, racists, and rednecks on the University of Illinois Board of Trustees drove out our chancellor, Nancy Cantor, because of her public opposition to Chief Illiniwek. Now, in all honesty, I've been here almost three decades. She's the best chancellor we've had in the time I've been here. And yet they got rid of her rather than their bigoted and racist little sports mascot. And she had so many I think, outstanding visions about the future of this university, new programs, where we're going, what we're going to accomplish. And they drove her out of town on a rail because of their support for this racist mascot. And our current chancellor, who was the provost at the time, got his job because he agreed, he supported Chief Illiniwek, and he's not going to get rid of it, and he's not going to rock any boats. I myself, as a professor, was publicly threatened by a member of the Board of Trustees at that time, David Downey, that he and the Board of Trustees were going to fire me because of my opposition to their racist little mascot. Indeed, the last time around, or the next to last time around, an effort was made by the Board of Trustees to rob me of my sabbatical because of my opposition to Chief Illiniwek. So what we've seen here, certainly at this university, I know Dartmouth got rid of their right. Indian mascot with no problem at all. There was some grousing by, right. you know, by the alumni, but, you know, they got rid of the darn thing. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen here is because of big-time sports and their attachment, the academic mission at this university being subordinated to sports and to the sports programs. And second, what we've seen then is we have a lot of problems with racism on this campus all up and down, and yet racism is being promoted and condoned and supported right at the very top of this university by the Board of Trustees. And now they've even been condemned by the NCAA, and they're still not going to get rid of this thing, and they're going to hold on to it.
Yeah. Well, it's not surprising, I think, that you have the issues and the incidents of racism on campus, given what you've just suggested. You would hope that the leadership within the institution would understand how that sort of thing trickles down and how debilitating those kinds of images can be to people of color that are fighting for their rights to get an education or to be respected on the campus and to be to have an opportunity to participate in all phases of the institution. And it's been a real bone of contention throughout the collegiate athletic world. I think there's still several dozen schools that have the Native American mascot. And, the one thing that I will say with regard to the caller's comments is my understanding, and maybe it's different at the University of Illinois as a state institution, I think, but the members of the Board of Trustees are voted on either by the alumni base or somehow get appointed. And so what is the reaction to those that are responsible for appointing those folks? At Dartmouth College, where the alumni actually vote on the slate of trustees, if we had an issue with the actions of the board, we could voice our opinion by whether we voted for that particular member on the slate or not. And to the extent that the folks in Champaign and around the country that are alumni of the university, they need to raise their collective voice and put the kind of pressure on, if in fact they do support the idea that the mascot should no longer be associated with the institution. Mm-hmm. I guess that's part of the question, is how do people at the university and the alumni really feel about it.
Yeah. Well, I would hope that our discussion doesn't now turn into a discussion of this particular issue, only because we have talked about it a lot.
Yeah.
It is
sure.
enormously controversial, and there are different points of view, and I know that there are people who would take great exception to what the caller said,
right.
people
right.
who see it very, very differently.
Right.
But that does give the opportunity to talk about the issue of racism, and I don't mean that specifically with regards to the chief,
right.
But racism generally in college sport, and this indeed also goes to this issue of this concern a lot of people have that athletes are being exploited, that they're being used, and that there are places where the chief concern is let's have a winning team, and there's not as much concern or enough concern toward the issue of are students getting an education or not.
Right.
Is that a problem?
Well, it definitely is a problem. It's a real concern. If you look at some of the graduation rates that that field fairly large, high-level athletic programs, especially in football and basketball, with regard to graduation rates of their student-athletes in general, and then their graduation rates for athletes of color, the African-American athletes, it has not been one that a lot of those schools would be proud of. In some cases, they haven't graduated anybody in a 6-year period, and there's just no excuse for it. And understanding that some of the rates that were created in the past didn't always take into consideration when an athlete left the university early to pursue a professional sports career, granted that may have skewed the statistics, but it didn't excuse all of the examples and the athletes included in that number. So there is an issue that people in the college athletics and college administration have to address with regard to the ability of their student athletes to compete successfully academically, their credentials when they are recruited, and making sure that they have all the requisite credentials and preparation so that they can be successful. It's not enough to say that they'll get by. I mean, I think they should be getting recruited to go to a particular school because they have the ability to be successful academically, socially, and athletically. And I don't think that that's always the manner in which the recruiting process takes place. And it needs to be addressed for sure.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other callers here. Next, someone in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I want to compliment both of you on the way you handled a response to the last caller. I had been going to call in to really give my blasting response to it because I think he was the kind of biased bigot that makes compromise impossible. But you handled it so beautifully that I'm just going to listen to the rest of the program. Thank you.
All right. Well,
thanks very much.
Then we'll just continue. We have another caller here in a community not far away from here, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, sir. I'd like to change the topic a little bit, get away from Mr. Alinowick. There's a situation here I do not understand with universities and stuff. When you talk about your major 3 sports, and it goes beyond that, baseball, basketball, and football, these sports are played on the university level, which gives young players, high school players, a chance to develop their skills and taught by people who know a lot about the game and bring them on and develop them as players. And then, whether it's after they graduate or before they graduate, they move on to a professional career. And these professional teams make a ton of money off the education, quote-unquote, that these people get in the sports arena at the university level. They get the experience and of everything playing at a higher level, but yet the professional teams don't ever pay for this information that these people are given that they carry on with when they become professionals. Now it seems to me that if the university is willing to raise the tuition for the students, why don't they charge a professional team so much for the increased experience that they've gotten from the college experience?
Well, it's an interesting point, and I think one of the reasons that they wouldn't want to do that is because then they would make it, they would confirm all the concerns that people have had about why people are going to college to play athletics, which is it's a minor league system for professional teams and leagues, and they don't really want to acknowledge that might be the relationship, and I think just as we wouldn't necessarily expect, even though there's grant programs and relationships that corporate entities have with universities and colleges around research. When they recruit on the campuses of the colleges for business people and medical folks or whatever it is, there's no quid pro quo that they give money to the institution. I think the benefit to the institution is that when they do hire their graduates, it sends a very powerful message that if you come to our school and get an education, that you'll be prepared to be competitive in the workforce. And I think the schools feel like that's repayment enough that they're actually hiring their folks. So what I have tried to do when talking about athletics and sport versus society is try to get people to look at sport and treat it the same way that they treat issues in society. And this is a perfect example. If we're preparing young people to be successful after their college careers are over in whatever profession they may choose to enter by getting a good job and being a productive member of society, sport should be looked at in the same way. And the difference is that, you know, usually when IBM or GE or somebody recruits somebody off the campus, it doesn't necessarily make the front page of the local paper or get on the evening news like the football team or the basketball team or other teams on the campus might, because of the level of interest we have in sport. And that's the difference.
I understand what you're saying, sir, but just to me, it doesn't seem like it's quite the same thing. I go to a university and I pay for an education,
right,
to become a physicist or whatever it may be.
Right.
The student athlete goes to the university and is usually compensated in some way to perform there, i.e. he gets a scholarship,
right,
or something like that. So he hasn't really paid for his education. I've paid for my education, and I want to go become whatever it is, work for Bell Labs or whatever.
Yeah.
In a football situation, it seems, or basketball or baseball or tennis or golf or whatever you want to put it in, It seems like it's slightly different from exactly the way you're putting it, sir.
Yeah.
These people are getting really something for nothing. I mean, not so much the student athlete, but the professional team.
Yeah. I mean, I understand the premise by which you're coming at it. I'm not sure that you have to understand the percentages in which professional the athletes end up playing professionally. You know, if you have a 90-person roster at the University of Illinois on their football team, there may be two players a year that are good enough to play in the NFL that come out of that program. And so, you know, do you in fact create a policy when 99% of the players participating aren't necessarily going to go on and play professionally? And I wouldn't want to send the message personally that this is a minor league system for the professional ranks, and that instead we should be sending the message that you're here to get an education to prepare you for what's next in your career. And if it happens to be that you play professionally, that's great, but let's make sure you can do everything you can to get a degree and have something to fall back on if you, in fact, aren't able to play for very long.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks. I think that points at the tough position that college administrators are in. Because when we get in these conversations, people say, let's not kid ourselves that big-time football, basketball programs particularly do function in part as a kind of a farm system for the NBA and the NFL, and that we ought to acknowledge that fact, and that perhaps, as the caller suggests, we should expect something back from the leagues, the professional leagues, and that if we say that somehow having a winning sports program is important to the university, maybe then we ought to really take the leap, and I don't know if such thing would ever be possible, but they say really take the leap and say, okay, let's start paying the athletes for playing, because that's really what it's some kind of semi-pro effort here. And we do want them to go to class and we want them to get a degree, but let's not kid ourselves about what it is we really expect them to do. Now, I don't know that any college actually ever could do such a thing. It's the kind of thing that has, whenever we talk about college sports, or at least, you know, for probably a couple of decades now, people have been saying that.
Yeah.
So it seems that we're in this really tough position where we can't really do that. But then, as we discussed earlier, we also can't can't do anything differently. It seems that there's really nowhere. We talk about reform of college sport, particularly right. at the top level. There doesn't really seem to be much of any place to go.
Well, I think you can reform college sports. I think it's already underway. To the point about paying athletes, we're already doing that by giving them a free education. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue is how much value do you place on it? How much value do they place on it? If you're an University of Illinois graduate, and you've worked hard, as the caller said, he paid his way through college, now he's got a good job, and he's proud of having his diploma on the wall when clients come in, what's that worth? And do you feel like it's worth enough that if you give someone 4 or 5 years of a free education at that institution, that it has real value? If you think about the kinds of tuition costs at private colleges and universities, it's upwards of $40,000 a year. And so you're talking about 4 or 5 years, depending on whether you go and redshirt or whatever, that you're talking about upwards of $160,000 to $200,000 in value. And so we are paying the athletes. We are acknowledging their athleticism, and we're giving them an opportunity to get a free education. One of the interesting things that you could suggest is, in terms of reforming athletics, is are the people that really need the money the most getting it? You know, the issues around the socioeconomic distribution on college campuses has become more and more of an issue, especially at some of the expensive elite institutions where they can't seem to be able to attract or get a number of kids that are under coming out of families that make under $40,000 a year. It's becoming less and less of an option for them for any number of reasons. That's a bigger issue for me than whether an athlete should get paid or not, because in reality, we are paying the athletes, and by saying that they're not getting anything for the amount of time that they're there playing on scholarship is to devalue the inherent value of the degree.
We have some other callers here. I want to get right to them. But for people who have just joined us, perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Peter Roby. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Sport in Society at Northeastern University in Boston and has been director since July 2002. By the way, if you're interested in the center and their activities, they do have a website, which is www.sportinsociety.org. So you can go there and find out more about the center. Before taking up his job at the center, he was vice president of U.S. marketing at Reebok, and then before that, he was a college basketball coach. He served 6 seasons as head basketball coach for Harvard University and 3 years as the assistant basketball coach. And before going to Harvard, he was assistant coach at Stanford, Dartmouth, and the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And then when he was in college, he went to Dartmouth. He also was a basketball player there. He was co-captain of the basketball team. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go to Terre Haute next in Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for this program. It should be a regular one. The problem is so deep and wide. In the culture and in our education system. It seems like whenever you read about the problems of big-time athletics, you get a couple of responses, and that is, one, that these programs make so much money. Is it not true, this is my first question, is it not true that most college, university athletic programs actually lose money? A second point I would raise some questions about is one you touched on in your last comment, and that is college presidents, athletic directors, the moneyed boosters in the best seats always talk about opportunities, and you're certainly giving opportunities to those students that can run fast or that have large size, that can dunk a basketball, but they might not be the best academically prepared to take advantage of a university education. If you're poor and you're smart, good luck.
Right.
But if you're if you can blaze down 40 yards of turf, it's welcome to college. So I'm not sure about that opportunity argument. In fact, I think it's bogus.
Right.
Another point, enhancing the college experience is what you often hear, you know, the rah-rah business. big sports for a small elite group of semi-students, I'm not sure if that's really an enhanced college experience for everyone. We seem to be teaching our students more to be spectators rather than participants. If sports is so good in character building and giving you competitive juices flowing, then why not make it for every student? We hear a lot about the physical fitness problem in this country, and yet we put big bucks into our elite athletes, and everyone else sits in front of the TV and watches 30 channels of sports or sits in the stadium and goes to the little benefits at the bars before and after the homecoming game. That's not participating. That's just spectating. A third point that's always brought up is national exposure. If we don't have national exposure in sports, our university or our college will go down the drain. I really don't know how many parents would decide where to send their kids to school on the basis of the one loss record of a football team or a basketball team or any sports team. If that's how choices are made by students or by the parents of students, then education's in bigger trouble than I ever thought.
Exactly.
Well, those are some of my thoughts. I particularly am interested in stating again and again that most colleges and universities lose money rather than make money.
Right.
So if you're losing money rather than making money, are we really allocating our resources, our limited resources, well?
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen to your response. Right. Sorry it was such a long comment.
Well, you raise many good questions, enough to keep us going for quite a while. We'll give the guest a chance to make some response. Thanks.
No, thank you. You're right. Some of the research that I've read suggests that there's only 40 colleges and universities in the country that are actually making money on their athletic programs, and even in those cases the numbers are a little bit fuzzy because they don't include all the costs of building the facilities in the formula in terms of revenue versus cost and expense. So but it's a myth to suggest that of the 350 or 60 teams that play Division I basketball, for example, that they're all making money. Almost all of them are losing money, except for the very biggest programs like a Syracuse or a UConn that are packing their stadiums every night and playing on television and taking advantage of the huge television revenue for their conferences and that sort of thing. So I think the caller is right to point that out. The second comment in regards to the national exposure that an institution will get from their athletic programs, I think he's right. Anybody that's really committed to their education should be spending more time thinking about the types of programs that they might study and the success rate of the graduates and the quality of the faculty and the student to faculty ratio than about what their teams have done in the Big Ten or the Big 12 or the ACC. Even though those things can be a fun part of the experience, and I don't blame kids for wanting to think about how that would be a fun part of their college experience. You know, all of the adults in a college in a young person's life need to be stressing the other more important decisions that they need to make with regard to where they end up going to school, and there is a short-term bump when teams go far into the NCAA tournament or they do well athletically. There certainly is an uptick in terms of applications and the interest, but it seems that the research suggests that that's a short-term thing. It's not a long-term thing. They refer to it as the Flutie effect. Doug Flutie was a great quarterback at Boston College here in Boston. He led his team to the Cotton Bowl. He won a Heisman Trophy, and they saw the applications kind of go through the roof, and BC was a national school. But BC has sustained their interest on the part of kids going to college based more on their academic reputation than anything that they've done athletically. And so I don't put a lot of stock into the value of that long-term, although short-term I think you could make the argument. Northeastern, where I'm located, is a perfect example of that. We haven't necessarily had any national programs in sports for many, many years, and yet they're having this incredible renaissance going on here where they're getting 25,000 applications for a private institution that costs over $40,000 a year. Because of the work that they've done to rebrand themselves, to increase the quality of the faculty, and put more into the physical plant of the institution, and not because of the investment they've made in athletics.
All right, well, let's continue here. See if we can get one or two callers in the time that remains. Next, we will talk with someone in Charleston, and that's line number two. Hello.
Yes. Have you discussed already the grandfather aspect of sports? The generations, I watched through my own family, son encouraged his sons, and then the college thing went into high school from junior high school into high school, then to junior college, and then the hope was on to a higher academic institution, all in the name of sports, and the how it impacted upon the lives of this particular family, and the disappointment and the agitation and all the other things that accrued from that. Have you addressed those things just yet? I tuned in a little bit late, but
no, we haven't talked about that, but you raise a wonderful point, because there's a trend now, especially in youth sports, that parents are hoping that if their kids can show a real proficiency in a particular sport, they want them to focus only on that, in the hopes that they might be able to move through the systems that they're playing in and ultimately get the attention of a college recruiter and pay for their education. And so there's a heightened expectation. There's a level of frustration when it doesn't go the way they hoped it would. And it's also resulting in a lot of young kids playing youth sports dropping out. The statistics show that of the almost 40 million kids that play youth sports in our country, 70% of them are quitting by the time they're 13, and the number one reason they give is because it's no longer fun. And I think the caller is referencing some of that pressure and the expectation to win and the long-term outcome of the participation, instead of it being about being with your friends and enjoying it and becoming a little more proficient and building your self-confidence and being physically fit. It's about, you know, you need to make the next team and you need to make the varsity and in high school and then ultimately get a scholarship. And you know, that's not really what sport was intended to do, but that's what our culture has gotten to because of the amount of exposure that it gets on the weekends and during the week and with all the attention that's paid to it.
Could I make one more comment, David?
Sure.
Yes. I have a little 9-year-old granddaughter, sweetest little thing. She played basketball in the local grade school here. I watched. I went several times and saw the same thing happen over and over again, that whoever was coaching these little girls, it was win at all costs. Mm-hmm. The team my granddaughter was on lost by like 30 points, and they just kept pouring it on.
Mm-hmm.
And then the little girl cried,
mm-hmm.
and most of the team, and I never went back.
Right, correct. That's exactly how it plays itself out. And the issue there that you so you explained so well is that the adults that are involved in all of this, they're doing it for what's best for them and not necessarily what's best for the kids involved. Too many adults are making decisions about what's going on in youth sports based on looking at it through their own eyes and their own perspective as opposed to what's in the best interest of the kids. And as a youth coach, you should be interested in coaching 9-year-olds in order for them to develop their skills, have fun, and want to be playing again as 10-year-olds. That's the only outcome that you should be interested in, and that should be your definition of success. Did the kids that I coached as a 9-year-old come back and want to play as a 10-year-old? And if they don't, you have to ask yourself why that is, and be willing to admit that maybe you were part of the reason. And so what happens when they get to college is this focus on specificity and being so focused on getting better as an athlete gives them more of a narrow perspective They can't take full advantage of all the opportunities that are available on a college campus. They're not as committed to their academics as they should be, and they don't fully engage in all the experiences, and so they end up being isolated, and people assume that they're not qualified, and the cycle continues.
Well, we're just about out of time. There's a lot of things we could talk about, not all of them bad, including the fact that now we have increased opportunities for girls and young women to play sports.
When
we were kids, it was pretty much all about the boys.
Right.
So it's not all bad. But, you know, maybe just real quick, the question is, when we look at those things that makes us unhappy about college sports, what's the likelihood that any of that's going to change?
Oh, I think it's going to change. It's already changed. As you suggested, Title IX, which was the legislation that allowed for equal access for women in education, is created incredible opportunities for women and girls to participate in sport and benefit from all that's good about sport. And I think with with Miles Brand as the president of the NCAA, as much as people may take umbrage to some of the things that he's initiated that may have impacted the University of Illinois in a negative way, I think as a former college president, the person that was willing to take on the issues that Bob Knight presented at Indiana and fire him to try to keep the thing in perspective, I think they've got the right person. I think they're sending a strong message with some of the changes that they're making to graduation rates and the loss of scholarships and eligibility requirements and all that. I think we're on the right track. I think the thing that we have to now do is we have to wrestle the issues around the money and the influence of money on college athletics to the ground. And if we can do that, then we have a chance to really have everybody benefit from all the positive things that you suggest are a part of sport,
yeah,
which I certainly agree with.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest is Peter Robey. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Sport and Society at Northeastern University in Boston. Mr. Robey, thank you very much.
My pleasure, David. Thanks for having me.